Welcome to Book Waves. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Elizabeth Alexander, who has a memoir, The Light of the World. Elizabeth Alexander is a poet. She is the Chancellor of the Academy of American Poets, Professor of Poetry at Yale. She has 6 books of poetry. There's a play in there called Diva Studies. Short stories have been published. She was the poet at the 2009 inauguration of Barack Obama and has known Barack Obama since 91, long time, correct?
Yes.
This book, though, is about the nature of grief. 3 years ago, Elizabeth's husband, Fikre, who was a very well-known chef at a restaurant, Café Adulis in New Haven, and he was also a painter as well. At the age of 50, he got on his treadmill and keeled over and died. It was a heart attack, massive heart attack at the time. He'd been healthy. He'd been exercising and eating well. He did smoke, however. Had he ever gotten his cholesterol checked?
Yes, and his cholesterol was a little bit elevated, you know, not so much that we thought we were in a crisis zone. And his approach, which he had brought it down with before, was to say he wanted to do it naturally. So it was more flaxseed, more blueberries, more treadmill.
This book is actually also about the nature of grief as well. In fact, it focuses on your own grief because the two of you sound like kind of soulmates.
Yes, absolutely. We had 16 years together. We decided when we met to just do it right away. We decided to get married in a week. We were both ready to start a family. We started a conversation that never stopped. Yeah, he was my soulmate.
You're a poet, and while you have essays, this is actually your first book. It's a memoir. Before we went on the air, you were talking about your favorite poet memoir, which is by Mark Doty. What prompted you to sit down and write a memoir? Because there are poems in the memoir, which obviously you're a poet. You're going to deal with these issues. But what prompted you to think about a different form?
Yeah, well, it didn't happen in a very mindful or deliberate way at all. After Fikre died and the earth had been so pulled out from under me, from under my kids, I was writing little bits, little fragments, words, phrases, words that floated. I didn't know where they belonged. I didn't know what they were. I didn't know what I was trying to describe. I just knew that I had to keep writing in order to have some attachment and understanding of what was happening, not even what I felt about it, what was happening. Then, moving to a few months later, an editor who I knew, had not worked with her, liked her, approached my agent and said, "If this is terrible, tell me to go away, but I think she could write something very beautiful about what happened to her if that's what she was inclined to do." And so I pulled myself together and got on the train from New Haven and went to New York and met with her. And at the end of it, had promised that I would write a memoir, even though I didn't actually really think I could do it. And I was very clear when I got the money, I put it in, I made its own bank account because I knew I would have to give it back. So because I didn't think that that's what I was doing, but Gretchen Young was a very, very important person in this process because she saw something before it existed and believed in it before it existed.
What's the difference between those little phrases or words and, say, if you're going to just write a poem?
Well, it starts the same way, and it feels like it comes from the exact same wellspring, which feels like it's somewhere in the center of my body. And it feels like you dive in, and you don't know what's in there, and it's dark, and you muck about, and you bring out some sounds, and you bring out some words, and you don't know the path that they're taking you on. And again, here now, everything's the same, poetry and writing this book. And then it turns into a shaped thing. As you know, the chapters in this book are quite small. They're of varied lengths. They're of different structures. So in some ways, it feels to me like a collection of poems. But what I actually enjoyed a lot once I had a lot of these little pieces was thinking, okay, how do I structure this into a larger whole? And how do I think of it as having both movement forward and story and also a kind of clarity? I wanted it to be very, very, very clear for readers.
Well, you go back and forth in time in each chapter. It skips around to more present when you're writing it, back to earlier, back to the moment he died, back to the day after. How were these written? Were they completely out of sequence, just pieces that somehow came together?
Yep, just one by one by one in no particular order at all. And even once I figured out what the five-part structure was, even once I figured out, okay, I wanted the bad thing to happen first. I didn't want anyone to page ahead to see what happened. The book was precipitated by a catastrophic event, and that's where it needed to begin. But then I thought, pretty soon after, I had to make you understand, well, who was this person? Who are these people? Why do you care about them? Why do you want to know what happens in their lives? And so that then became the second part.
Had you thought at some point, well, wait a second, maybe this can be like an epic poem? Had that crossed your mind?
No, although you would think it would have.
Right.
And, you know, I've been thinking a lot. A book I really, really love is by my friend Ed Hirsch. It's called Gabriel, and this is a book that's an epic poem about the untimely loss of his son, around the same time, actually. And his book came out a little bit before mine did. So we've talked about why is it that, you know, coming from this same wilderness of grief, we would each make books in these different and particular forms, and I don't know what the answer is. Mysterious.
But this is very different from, say, your short story writing or your essays, coming from a very different place.
Oh, very different. I mean, with essays, which I really enjoy writing, essays about mostly African-American culture, literature, film, art, even if I don't know exactly where my thinking is going when I start out, there comes a point where making a point takes over, where proving a case, building a case, explaining something, showing something, doing a close reading, explicating, opening it up, that job, that work is why the essay is going to exist in part. So there was not that sense of this is the job of this work. And I was also working against my own inclination not to write memoir, not to, in the great expression, put my business in the street, you know, not to expose my children in any way. So there was all of that saying, this is an odd thing for you to be doing, but it felt that it had to be written.
What about a self-censor saying there are certain things that I don't want anybody to know?
Well, I'm sure there are things that I did not write, of course, but I also knew that I had to be truer and opener than I had ever been before, maybe, in order to, again, not only do justice. I wasn't trying to write a sort of monumental portrait of a great man, even though he's a great man. I was trying to be true to something that I was going through at the same time that I was writing it. So word by word, I didn't know what the it was. And so that demanded a very, very rigorous adherence to a kind of internal truth.
Elizabeth Alexander, you've got all these ideas and these thoughts, and some of them are on paper and some of them are not, and you have your friend help you. But there's got to come a point where it has to be seriously organized. Did the organizing come before the actual writing?
That came, I would say, when I was a little more than halfway done. And that's actually how it also happens with books of poems. I'm extremely superstitious when I'm writing. And so I write, I print it out, I put it in a folder. I don't look in the folder. I don't even crack the folder except to put something else in until I have a rather thick stack, because I'm afraid that if I open it and I look and there's not quite enough, if it doesn't feel hefty, that then I will be thrown into despair and there will be no book. So after I had a pile, I did the intuitive thing that's, again, how I put together books of poems. I sort of made piles. You want to go with this. You want to go here. And I sort of move the piles around, and that's how an organic sense of shape starts to emerge. And then comes a part that I really love, which is the shaping, the getting your hands in, the fixing, the making orderly. It's like cleaning an untidy room. Highly satisfying at the end.
Well, one difference between poetry and prose is that poetry, every word has to be in the right place and the right word. So it's almost like a mosaic of individual words. Prose is a little different from that, or is it?
This prose is not for me. This prose, to me, had to have the exact same quality and character and caliber, word by word, of poetry.
When you hit those points where you kind of would freak out, what would Fikre do? How would he deal with you freaking out?
Me freaking out? He was an extremely calm human being. He did not raise his voice maybe once a year. Very, very cool waters, very, very even, very, very comforting, and our particular yin-yang. I'm the mommy who yells and then apologizes 30 seconds later, and he's the parent who would just stay calm. He would quote from his parents. He said that his father used to say to his mother, who I actually experienced in the few years I was fortunate to know her before she passed, as also being a very cool waters woman, but he said that his father would say, okay, it's time to take a Panadol, a way of saying take a chill pill, in the nicest way, though.
He grew up in Eritrea before Eritrea fell apart, right?
He grew up in the middle of the long war for independence, and so first Haile Selassie was ruling, and then Mengistu Haile Mariam ran a dictatorship there, and so he grew up with killing fields and soldiers breaking in the house, and fellow students disappeared from school, and very, very dire political circumstances, although a very, very pacific home circumstance.
What did he think of all of the Sturm und Drang of American politics after having been in a situation where every day is life or death?
He was a very sharp and informed political analyst, and he always put things into a global context. I think that some of that is just that when people grow up outside of the United States, they tend to have a global context.
Right.
They speak languages. They, you know, have to think about the world in a different way. And I think particularly growing up in Africa, growing up somewhere that has dealt with colonialism of various kinds, it makes for very sharp politics and a very keen sense of understanding always the longer historical line of things. For him, Obama having an African president, he had nothing but pride for him, nothing but pride.
You know, knowing Obama, how do you differentiate the pride from the policy?
So we were faculty members together at the University
yeah.
of Chicago and lived in Hyde Park, a very wonderful, smallish community where you kind of find your people pretty quickly. You can have an analysis of politics and still find it absolutely remarkable that this is someone who we are so lucky that he's our president. I mean, consider the alternative. That's all I have to say. Consider any number of alternatives. And this is not, a defense per se. I think none of us knows not only what it is to have that job, but also what it is to have that job as a black person. I think that there is a kind of incalculable what does that mean that plays into what it's meant for him to try to do that job well.
Has he ever talked to you about specifically just being a black man as president?
No, and if he had, I would never speak of it publicly, ever.
But that does bring up the question of when you are having a conversation and you know that, is a little part of you going, well, down the road, this is history?
No, I don't think that way. You know, I think growing up in Washington, D.C., my parents moved from New York. I was born in Harlem. That's where they're from. And moved to work. My dad did civil rights work for President Johnson, was the first head of the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. At a time, you know, as Johnson's head civil rights advisor, when amazing things were happening,
right.
The Voting Rights Act, Civil Rights Act. So, you know, growing up in that Washington, it's always historical, but it's also always every day. Speaking the inaugural poem from the steps of the Capitol, I was six blocks from my childhood home. That was where I used to go and walk, used to be able to walk without having guns trained on you on the grounds of the Capitol and around Washington, D.C. So that's a kind of interesting thing about growing up there, is that the historical part is quite oddly normalized.
You're listening to an interview with Elizabeth Alexander, whose memoir is titled The Light of the World. I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves. There are two elements in this that gravitated to me. One was the fact that as of the recording of this interview, I'm 3 weeks away from having had two stents put into arteries near my heart. And I got lucky. Had there been no symptoms, there's a possibility I would have wound up like Fieger. The other thing is that a couple of years before, my mom had died, and I grieved. In your research on Fikre afterward, you know, you say in The Light of the World that the stress of having grown up in Eritrea could have affected him. And I talked to my cardiologist and said, what is the relationship of stress to heart disease? And she pretty much couldn't give me an answer. What did you find out?
Well, you know, it's interesting because there was that period of trying to understand how it's like you can't believe your eyes. He was run down, as I write about in the book, for 2 days beforehand. I'm tired every day. I mean, you know, you think, okay, get a little extra rest. But trying to reconcile when you look at your beautiful, robust, healthy partner, and then you think all of this was happening inside that you couldn't see. And then in my research afterwards, because you got to do the research to lay it to rest in some way, I was surprised to learn for how many people they don't know about heart disease until it's killed them. It seemed like we must be the only people in the whole world to whom this happened. But then, of course, also when anything terrible befalls you, you hear the stories. It's like you're a magnet for the stories to come to you. And so I spoke to a number of cardiologists. There are a lot of doctors in New Haven. And actually, a lot of doctors at the restaurant that Fikre and his brothers ran, Cafe Adulis, it was a big medical school hangout. So there was a sort of lovely, people talked to the Adulis widow. The doctors did. I could get them on the phone because they had eaten my husband's food. And they talked to me at great length. And more than one said to me, to their mind, unquestionably, why wouldn't a lifetime of stress be a toll on the heart or on the body over time? It seems logical to me in the way that I think that we know whenever we've gone through a stressful time, it somatizes it. You can get a migraine or you can, you know, some part of your body feels it. So the idea that that would chip away over time doesn't seem so strange to me. Now, who knows what the complex brew of, you know, being a smoker and how that also relates, I think, to the stress as well. Right. He wanted so desperately to quit. He tried to quit every day we were together and probably a million days before that, but it had a very strong grip on him. And then with, you know, a kind of a genetic predisposition to not alarming cholesterol, but, you know, elevated cholesterol, who knows how all of that comes together. But I also know that for, and I write about this a little bit, for middle-class black men, you know, he did not grow up in this country, but there are many, many, many disproportionate stressors on black men that can contribute to a much higher mortality rate.
Elizabeth Alexander, in asking those questions, obviously for you, it's not so much finding the same kind of answers that I'm looking for. It's trying to deal with something inside you, right?
Well, yeah, and I also feel that after a point, after a certain number of conversations with a certain number of doctors, nothing brings him back. And to me, it goes back to a couple of things about how we live each day. First of all, you know, are you settled with the people you love? Are you good to the people you love? And that's why so much of the book is about daily rituals, small rituals, doing things in the intimacy of family. Because I think the only reason I could even move forward, the only way I could even write this book is because we were peaceful with each other. Not perfect, not any of that, but peaceful with each other. And I think also, as my dad would say, you can woulda, coulda, shoulda forever. And not only does none of it bring him back, you know, well, what's the lesson? Don't smoke, for sure. But what are you going to do about that now? You know, I think that there's even a kind of demonization in this country of people who smoke. I mean, we know it's a terrible, terrible, terrible thing. I find it awful myself, but human beings are fallible. None of us every single day does every perfect thing. And at the end of the day, we just do the best we can and hope for a spiritually peaceful and healthy life. You know, you are grateful for what you do get.
Is there such a thing as closure? And on top of that, should there be such a thing as closure?
On this book tour, I got a question about what is the recipe for kind of getting over it. And I said, we should be marked by sorrow and grief. It shouldn't be easy to get over your mother. You should never get over your mother. You should be functional. I think we should all be functional. I have these kids. I don't want them to live fearfully. I want them to live joyfully. I want them to live into their beautiful futures, and they do. And I'm very, very proud of that in my mothering and proud of them. But at the same time, and this is why, you know, we talk about Fikre and wherever it takes us, if it takes us to tears or laughter, we go there. We lost what was precious to us. The question that remains, I think, is what are we left with? Because I think we're left with so much, but the only way that I know that is in the talking about and moving through and continuing to measure the loss.
Do you feel better having written the book? I mean, does that...
I don't feel better. I feel that alongside the writing of the book, I have also moved forward in the grieving process by virtue of time. The book doesn't make me feel better about the loss of Fikre, but I feel fantastic about the book because I made something. And because not only do I feel that I'm still a productive artist, and that's what he believed in more than anything in the whole wide world, but I've taken it in a new direction, and so I'm proud of that work. I'm proud to know that I can do something different and that I'm not just shut down.
So in that sense, writing the book in a very real way has changed your art.
It has. It really has.
Have you written much poetry since writing the book?
Not a drop.
Really?
Not a line, not a word. Nope. And so I think that I don't take that. I'm glad you asked that because I myself have dramatized. What does it mean? You know, maybe I'll never write poetry again. Well, I will write poetry again, but what I think is more important is the reason I haven't written any is that I finished this book relatively recently. So I just feel like I just did some work and I'm in that kind of pulling myself together period that always comes after finishing a big work. But I think the most important thing is, well, I'm working and I have been working. I think with most artists, I can speak for myself, it's not about is it a poem, is it an essay, it's about are you working.
Let me ask you, Elizabeth Alexander, about poetry. When I was doing my research, I came across the fact that your poem at Obama's inauguration did not get good reviews. And I was thinking, you know, I talked to Mark Doty, and I said, what makes a good poem? And he said, a poem is what moves you. If you're moved to turn it around in your mouth and read it and say it, and it affects you. So my question is, how could any reviewer actually get a handle on any poetry? And how can we know what's good and what's bad poetry, or should we?
First, to the inaugural poem, it got some bad reviews, but it actually didn't only get bad reviews. And I say that not to be defensive, but to put it all in perspective, because, and I'm glad for the opportunity to do so, because the bad reviews have really, really, really assumed a proportion that is not accurate to not only what was out there, but also to the tremendous, tremendous, powerful, like mailbag, USPS mailbags full of actual paper mail that told me something about response and that I continue to hear afterwards. And I think that one of the challenges for any poem in that moment is that usually someone comes to a poem on a piece of paper. And so one of the things that is part of the nature of poetry is that you look back at it, you go back and you see, well, how is it made? And let me think about that. And so the challenge of writing a poem that most people won't ever read. And, oh, by the way, look, most people who reviewed it didn't even read it. You know, they were reviewing a performance that was a kind of unusual circumstance of performance. I did want to get that straight.
That wasn't the reason that I was asking.
No,
question.
I understand. I'm taking the opportunity, though, and thanking you for it, because that's like been stuck in my craw for a long time, along with, you know, the scourge of just comment sections where, you know, everyone who wants to say anything can say something, and that's not always so good. But how do you know if a poem is good or bad? I think there are a lot of different measures, and it depends on what we're trying to do with it. So if I'm in a classroom, I never start from is it good or bad. I talk about how does it work. The first thing we do is we read it out loud, and they have it in front of them. And then I say, what do you notice? What do you hear? And I remind people that I think at the very first level, a poem is like a piece of music. It happens to you. It washes over you. You listen to it. Is there, you know, some kind of felicity, even if it is a jagged felicity? what do you hear there? What do you notice? And then we start to be able to look at and talk about the patterns and the devices and the ways that poetry works. And I find that those questions are richer than good or bad, and that in the kind of widespread way that I know that so many people for whom poetry means something to them, I'm not going to get in the way of what they do or don't like, because I think that at that level it is subjective. And why mess with someone's pleasure?
Then let's go back to the difficulty with something like that inaugural poem. When you're writing a poem, the assumption is, as you say in your class, you're going to sit there and you're going to go through it maybe more than once, or as Mark Doty says, roll it over your tongue.
Mm-hmm.
And yet this is completely different. It's one performance in and out, and how can you really measure it, because it's not being considered like a real poem?
Well, occasional poems in that regard have a very strange life. But for myself, in just thinking about did I do a good job or did I not do a good job, I thought about did I write a poem that would fall hopefully somewhere in the middle of all the work I'll make in my life, hopefully, and does it stand up next to its brothers and sisters? And in that regard, I felt like I did a good job.
But what does that mean, do a good job?
For me, very personally, I think as for any poet, you know, to write something where every word is necessary, where it has music, where it imparts something, where the images are surprising, something well made.
But isn't that going to be the case with every single poem that you ever publish?
Yes, that's what I mean by can it stand up to its brothers and sisters. So
okay.
I held myself to the same standard that I always hold myself. Many, many poems I've written that I do not publish because they don't live up to my standard.
Elizabeth Alexander, when you look at your own poems, can you separate yourself out and view them as if someone else wrote them?
Yes. You know, sometimes when I'm teaching writing, I've done it a lot over the years. I don't do it a lot right now, but one of the things I talk about is separating your editor, and I picture mine as like a little person who looks like me, who I can put, you know, she can sit on my shoulder or I can take her off my shoulder if she's interfering, and that there is the making mind and then there is the editing and evaluating mind. So I have those two minds.
In something like a book like The Light of the World, it might be hard to separate it because, you know, you've put your tears on a page.
Yes, literally, because I cried every day making it and writing it. But, you know, I'm a shark when it comes to my writing, and I think that most serious writers are. I'm absolutely ruthless with myself. And you just come out of that, you know, you have to sort of open wide, let it all out, but then the editorial self is just absolutely like a sharp, sharp sword.
Did you learn any of that from Derek Walcott, or was it?
I did. Yeah. He was my only poetry teacher and the only one I ever needed. And, you know, he was maximally exacting, and he always held poems up to great poems written over time. He would spend class time talking not about our poems, we would do that in his office, but about why a poem that he thought was great was great. And he could carry on for 2 hours about a single poem.
I forgot who I spoke with, but somebody who either teaches writing or writes poetry once said that it's remarkable you can take the great poems and sight unseen give them to a class and see how they respond. And I think she was thinking of Emily Dickinson at that
mm-hmm.
point. And the same poems will affect people, and you can almost tell that makes a great poem.
That's interesting. I mean, you know, part of what, as a professor of African American literature and African American studies, one of the really exciting things that's been part of my now 3 decades doing this is doing the scholarly work and the teaching work to bring more poems by African Americans, more art by African Americans into that conversation of what we consider great.
Are you being successful? Are there more great African-American poets now?
It's not that there are more great poets. It's that we have more developed tools. The canon has been opened up, and this all ties to political struggles for inclusion, you know, to the civil rights movement, to movements on campus to create African-American studies. You know, so all of that has added up to some really great things. the talent and the creativity has always been there, but now theaters and publishing houses and universities have opened up as they have needed to.
Which do you think has been harder for you, racism or sexism?
You know, I can't be one thing or the other thing. I really sort of analytically come out of Black feminist intersectionality that people like Kim Crenshaw and Audre Lorde and, you know, have written about, that you cannot separate pieces of your identity, that you have to name yourself, as Audre Lorde says, that she talks about how all the journey woman pieces of who we are in operation at the same time, and that we actually disaggregate at our peril.
Do you worry about the political crossing into the artistic, or will that always happen no matter what you do?
It always happens. You know, Toni Morrison gives a really wonderful, clear explanation and breakdown of the word politics to the polis, you know, having to do with the community. And that's what art does. Art's about individual people in society everywhere you go. So one art is no more or less political than the next because of who's saying it. One of the things that I really learned and am learning that's been so fascinating to me about this book is that, you know, we know and teach that the universal comes from being crisp with the particular.
Right.
And so what I'm finding in this, you know, very, very particular story about these particular people is that so many different sorts of people are responding to it. So I feel that it must be true.
Elizabeth Alexander, where are you going to go from this? Do you have any idea? Do you think you're going to write another play at some point?
Who knows? What was both wonderful and hard about writing a play, it was a verse play, I figured that would be my way in, is that I loved the collaboration. I loved that there were actors and set designers and directors and people who had very different skills and talents than I had, and that together we could make a spectacle that was thrilling. That was absolutely wonderful. But the solitariness of writing, I mean, it is very jarring to go from that aspect of the process to the collective aspect of the process. I don't know what's next, because I think that this book is still really taking me by the scruff of the neck into some very, very interesting human things, and I don't know what they will be. So I'm just really following the road.
You've been listening to an interview with Elizabeth Alexander, whose memoir is titled The Light of the World. I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves.